Welcome to the Fire and Beer Podcast. I am your host, Marcel Gomez. Today, I'm with Chris Maestro, principal owner of Beer Wax, located in Brooklyn, New York. If you're like me, you may have a lot of friends that dream of opening a bar, but don't take the time or are unable to take the risk to do so. This was not the case with Chris. Chris fell in love with music. It was Jam On It by Nucleus. Then he was a metalhead for a little bit. Then he fell in love with the golden era of hip-hop, in my opinion, the 90s. And we can thank BDP's My Philosophy for that. When Chris was teaching, in his summer's break, he would travel and visit multiple places around the world. One of those trips was to Hong Kong, where he discovered his passion for craft beer. He had a beer called Semi-Claus, which at the time was the highest ABV beer in the world. It was at 14%, which led him to start a craft beer blog, get Cicerone certified, experiment with home brewing, which eventually led him to be the bar manager at Finback. All of this rich history in both music and craft beer led to his pursuit to opening a bar that showcased both of his passions. This led to Beer Wax, a craft beer bar that holds over 5,000 vinyl records, the first of its kind in New York City. Chris, thank you very much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Marcel. It's good to be here.
It's great to be here. I'm sitting in this beautiful bar, unfortunately shut down due to the current guidelines of COVID.
The inside is, we still have the outdoor dining option, but when it's 30 degrees, there's only so much a space heater is going to do for you. But, you know, there are folks that continue to come and want to support. We're losing a lot of money. It's kind of like the early days of COVID right now, with our percentages of revenue loss is through the roof. You know, I'm going to keep pushing it, remain open, pivot in any direction we need to, and just hope for the best, hope that we can outlast this COVID winter.
Yeah, you just celebrated your four-year anniversary.
Third year
anniversary. Yep.
Which was a very strange celebration because we couldn't really pack the bar.
Right.
It was a little bittersweet, but still have to celebrate.
And that same week, it was announced that indoor dining was going to get shut down.
Yeah. Luckily, we had at least two more days. It was really Saturday and Sunday was the two celebration days, and Monday was the day that it went into effect of the indoor dining closure. So luckily, we were able to celebrate inside, but it's still very limited, the amount of seating. We have, what, space for 12 to 14. So it felt very different this year in terms of celebrating.
Are you able to have the back open, the new guidelines?
Yeah, we can have the back open.
The back is a patio area. Right now it has tents over it. What's really cool about it is that it has vine grapes going ahead of it.
Yeah.
And I was actually looking it up. You every year harvest them, right? And
we
donate them?
Yeah, well, the first year they went to waste because we didn't know what we were doing.
Right.
We picked the grapes as they started falling and making a mess. And we were trying to do something with them. I put them in a plastic tub and I forgot. I left them out in the hot sun. I came back a day later and it was ton of flies, smelled disgusting. So we lost out that first year. The second year, we partnered with Rooftop Reds. They're basically a rooftop winery here in Brooklyn. And they have a nonprofit called Village Vines that tries to go and find local grapevines in Brooklyn and harvest them. So in collaboration with them, we made a wine with those grapes in the backyard. Tasted okay, to be quite honest, but I'm more excited, to be honest, about our collaboration this year with Big Alice. The folks from Big Alice harvested the grapes. My daughter, Jessie, who was our assistant manager here, and myself, we went over to Big Alice. We basically plucked the grapes from the vines, and then we blended them, and then put them in some oak. So the barrel was a white wine barrel, and then we just took a kettle sour, introduced it into that barrel with the puree of the grapes. And we can't wait to see what funkiness is going to come out in a couple of months.
That's pretty incredible, Ben.
So yeah, that is the pinnacle of our backyard grape collaborations will be this year coming up.
So that would be a Saison or a farmhouse?
Yeah, probably be a farmhouse. We'll see what kind of funk from the wild yeast from basically those grapes and what we're on the grape skin. So we'll see.
That's actually pretty awesome. And, you know, just going out there was something that you inherited, right? And now you're making use for it. Last time I was here, which was in August, my wife was grabbing the grapes.
That's right. No, and they're edible. You know, some people would, as long as they're not still green, they taste pretty, kind of like a Concord grape in a sense. Right.
So. Right. Very cool. Well, listen, let's crack open a beer.
Let's do it.
Do you happen to have an opener with you?
Yeah, you know, we have one here at the bar.
Yeah. We are.
But I also have one in my pocket, so I come prepared.
This is where I am. Called, maybe you can pronounce it better than I can, Cuvée de Cuvée.
Yeah. I guess so. Couvée? I don't speak French. I assume that's French, but we'll just call it the Couvée. Yeah.
Some side projects. Yeah. It was actually part of the Beer Bowl Time bundle pack. So I'm really excited to try this.
Should I do the honors?
Yes, absolutely. Right. Please. Thank you. Nice golden color.
Beautiful.
You've done this before.
A few times.
So we were talking a little bit off air before I started recording. I didn't really know where exactly I wanted to take this episode. You've been so well documented, and I hope I covered it and did it justice in the intro. Who you are, what your interests were, how you got started, and started this beautiful bar. And it's crazy to think it's the first in NYC. There's been a couple people that's taking your idea and a concept and move it on. Obviously not to the extent that you have. When I reached out to you, I sent you an email and I said, hey, I've been to other bars that have craft beer and play hip hop.
Yeah.
But after visiting your bar, I feel like for everyone else was an afterthought.
Mm.
How did you go in and take this concept that you had, not only bring it to life and will it together, right? You were a teacher. You weren't a huge investor in other businesses or bars. This is something that you had some experience bar managing at Finback, and you built this passion with music and its collection. You willed this together, but how did you make it and continue to maintain it to be authentic to both? How do you do that?
It's really just having that authentic passion for both of those things and really honestly loving both dearly and realizing that there really wasn't a place that married those things under one roof, at least in New York City. So it was just a real kind of ignited this fervent fire to make it happen. And just really not just being this thing like, oh, you know, like some hipster that thinks vinyl records and craft beer would go well together and may sell. No, it was like both of those things independently were things that were huge passions of mine. And I could have just opened up a record store, or could I just opened up potentially a brewery if I really considered following my passion for homebrewing. But I just said, let me figure out a way to curate both of those things under one roof.
Yeah, it shines. It definitely comes through. When you look around here, you see books that are both related to beer and music, right? You have records everywhere, local art on the walls, t-shirts that say, no requests, please, right?
And that's our logo pretty much. Right?
So don't ask to play any songs in here. And your DJs are only allowed to spin vinyl, no Serato,
right.
No phones, no any of that.
Yep.
And you have this great vibe. There's a lot of beer places that can make someone that's maybe just getting introduced to beer feel uncomfortable walking in. And this is far from that.
Yeah.
You know, you can come in here and just love hip hop and not necessarily be a craft beer fanatic and get an education in craft beer. And maybe it would change your views on just drinking a Corona or Modelo and,
exactly.
and coming over.
And I think we've done that for particular people that were here because Lodge Professor was spinning.
Yeah.
And like, what do you drink? Oh, you know, I drink usually Modelo or, you know, Heineken or whatever. We got some for you. And then now slowly they moved on to IPAs, you know?
Right.
So it's been cool to see that progression and folks that were regulars because of the music and now come back for double dry hop to double IPA, you know?
So right.
It's been great.
Cheers, my man.
Have some of this. Cheers.
Oh, wow. Mm. Just the right amount of like tartness to it, right?
That's
Side
great.
Project's a beast, man.
That is great.
So like, how cool is that statement? Lodge Professor came here to DJ.
Yeah.
And then you're like, hey, man, let me show you this other thing I love. And now he's into it.
Yeah. I pinch myself, you know. And on both sides of things, like to have had amazing DJs come through and do very intimate sets here. It's a small venue. So when you come here and we have a great DJ, you're literally walking right by him or her. So as just a longtime fan of hip hop, of music in general, to have had some legends come through the doors, not just to spin here, but even just to come and check the place out.
Yeah, Bobito, right?
Yeah, he was...
For people
yeah.
who don't know who he is,
yeah,
can
definitely.
You explain who he is and why him asking you
yeah.
to DJ here?
I mean, that's huge. So Bobito Garcia, along with Stretch Armstrong, founded in 1990 the most renowned and most important college radio station, underground hip-hop radio station. Well, radio show, I should say, because it was on WKCR, which was a college radio station out of Columbia University. So they started this radio show as kids in their 20s. Stretch was the DJ, Bobito was the host, and they went on to have some of the most notable, at the time, unsigned MCs and DJs, but mostly MCs, that will come through to freestyle or kick a verse from one of their in their new songs. So they've had Biggie before Biggie was signed. They've had Nas before Nas was signed. Wow. Wu-Tang members, various, and sometimes the whole crew before they released Enter 36 Chambers. So we're talking about they, in many ways, were the gatekeepers for these acts that now have become the most legendary hip-hop acts in the world. And at the time, that was like, if you don't go and perform a stretch in Barbido, you're not going to get anywhere because that's what you have to do to get to that next level.
They were the gatekeepers.
They were the gatekeepers. So I have a long history with Barbido in general. I don't know if we should get into the whole thing.
Why not?
I mean, we can. I wrote, it's all in a quick scene in their documentary, Radio That Changed Lives. I had a very brief cameo in that film. It used to be on Netflix. I'm not sure if it's still on Netflix, but you can just Google it, Stretch Armstrong, Barbido, Radio That Changed Lives. The last two thirds of that documentary, I have a small little 1 minute piece. I was asked to be part of the filming because I wrote Stretch and Barbido a very angry letter when I was in college. Because they, at a certain point, I was in my high school years, every Thursday night, I'd stay up late and record the show. I have still a whole shoebox of tapes. So it was like something that was such an important part of my upbringing and my love of hip hop in those early days. So when they went to Hot 97, I was so enraged that in my mind went out, like sold out. They went from, in my mind, like a smaller audience, almost a small close-knit community, to now going to the most mainstream radio station. So we thought, and not just myself, but a whole bunch of us, like, oh, they're sellouts. They're, what we had in the special joy was now for everyone.
Right. You were trying to keep that circle.
Yeah.
Small.
So in a sense, I was like 19. It was a bit selfish of me. And I didn't understand, like, now in hindsight, in having conversations with both of them, like, we didn't get paid for that. We just wanted to have a bigger platform for what we were already doing. But I wrote them this angry letter. All this time, Barbido held on to that letter.
Get out of here.
So, and since then, like, I remember meeting him and then I introduced myself as Black Cloud, what I was known as back in the day. That's how I signed the letter. And then we kind of squashed whatever quote unquote beef we had. And ever since then, he always remembers me. And then he started a store called Footworks that was in Manhattan in the Lower East Side. And that became in many ways like the hangout of my graffiti crew that I was part of called TCK. My very close friend Vaz was also in the movie, was the manager of Footworks. So I would see Barbido pretty often because that was our hangout. And then he always remembered me and he has a great memory. So all these years later, even when I was an educator, I would invite him to come speak to my students. And he came on three different occasions to speak to various students of mine. So we've had this relationship. So fast forward to Beer Rack starting. I said, listen, I'm starting this thing, vinyl only DJs. I would love for you to spin. And at first he was like, yeah, you know, when you're up and running, when you have other folks coming through, I'll come check it out. And, you know, but he never committed. He never gave any kind of like sign that he like, he would definitely be down. And then one day I get a random call and he's like, yo, B. I'm like, who's this? He's like, it's Barbido. He's like, I'm standing at your bar right now. He's like, I'm blown away. And he said, listen, I never do this, but people always come to me and ask me to spin at their venue. I want to come spin here. And that was one of the biggest like cosigns and humbling moments to have Barbido say like he wants to come spin at my bar. So
that's insane. That story is incredible. You wrote an angry letter. What are the chances that he held it? And then you had the chance to interview him to ask him about it.
Yeah. I went to the filming of the documentary. I go to my friend Vaz's house, so that's where they set up the camera crew. And he handed me the letter. I hadn't seen the letter in what, like 20 years or something. And he said, does this look familiar? And I almost didn't even recognize the handwriting. But I'm like, oh yeah, that's my kind of toy graffiti writing back then.
Right, right. And right, guilty of that too.
And he's like, listen, you can either read it beforehand or read it again in front of the camera spontaneously. And that's what I did.
Wow.
And I didn't even realize at the end of the letter, I call Stretch a corporate whore.
Oh, no.
So Stretch is sitting on one side, Barbido's on the other side. And they're all kind of waiting, knowing that I'm going to get to the very end and call Stretch a corporate whore. And then we all just started laughing. It was kind of like the comedic part of the film. Because I just didn't even realize I was that brutal with them. So for Barbido to like, after all that, to still come and call me and say, listen, I want to spin in your bar, and was a regular DJ for almost a full year, was amazing.
That's insane, man. And you know what I've been thinking about a lot is that when the 80s and 90s, when hip hop really started and flourished, people our age weren't listening to it for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was just if you were young in that area, kind of a rebel, right? You were into that music. And then it started to build commercial value as time went. Now there's a bunch of men and women, mid-30s, early-40s, mid-40s, early-50s, that are listening to hip-hop today, and how that culture and that dynamic has completely changed and evolved.
Mm.
It used to be, hey, turn that off. What are you listening to? To turn that up. That's my jam.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And now people that have grown up listening to hip-hop and that is their scene now have dispendable income.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
I'm sure, you know, if you were to price out your vinyl collection, you can probably get an incredible amount of money for that, right? People are buying street art.
Yeah.
Which was once disgusting mm-hmm. to people, right? And they would kill to get it off their walls and for the stop are now paying these artists to do these murals.
Exactly.
All birth from hip hop,
right?
Because we appreciate now at our older age. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the new generation of hip hop, what is it telling you? For instance, our teenage to early 20s, it would be really easy to say, or even in our mid 20s, like who's the top five greatest rappers of all time? And you'd say, you know, whatever order, Nas, Jay-Z, you know, so forth and so on. But if you ask someone in that age now, that could be Lil Wayne, A$AP Rocky.
Yep.
Right? And you had rappers like maybe Lil Yachty being like, I don't, you know, Pac's overrated.
Mm.
Right? And so the state of hip hop is completely different. It used to be about selling drugs. Now it's about
using them.
Using drugs, right?
Yep.
And that's a general. We still have Kendrick, who's I would still consider new school, mm-hmm. you know, J. Cole.
Like amazing lyricist.
Absolutely incredible, right? I always, when I do a bottle share or something at my house and I get pretty saucy, I put on Control. And I'm like, he just challenged everybody. Everyone's like, yeah, no, man, we've heard this song like four times because of you. But like, what's your state on that? What's your thought on where hip hop was kind of this rebel status, right? And you were really upset that Bob Beadle went to Hot 97, Stretch Armstrong, and now it's become this worldwide thing where people that were just doing this for fun and to be an outcast, you know, could potentially make millions doing a mural or setting trends on the fashion scene of what hip hop is, like guys like Dapper Dan, so forth and so on, right? And then us as those kids, now adults maturing and seeing what we can do, like, and plus the new generation of hip hop, where do you see that all come together?
Whew, that's a lot there in that question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate that some people that were the pioneers that did amazing art are not getting compensated for what they did and what they started.
Right.
So just that alone is a travesty.
Does someone come to mind when you think of that?
I mean, Grandmaster Theodore, you know, some of the original folks, Grandmaster Flash, you have folks that are sick and struggling to pay hospital bills. So on that alone, that's unfortunate, right? But listen, then you have some people that are true to their art form, that have been grinding and are now successful, but have stayed, you know, authentic, and they have a lot of love for the culture, and they figure out ways to monetize their craft. More power to them. As long as they're not culture vultures and really taking advantage of the culture. But, you know, I can't really speak to a lot of the new hip hop. There was a time that I thought that we should even consider like trap music a whole different genre or like a spinoff of hip hop.
Right. I believe that it is.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Exactly.
It used to be hip hop and rap.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You go to a record store, it'd be hip hop and rap. You're like, wait a minute.
Like, which is which? You know,
right. So, how do you sub, you know, Onyx would be in rap or something.
Yeah.
Like
it was,
that.
If it was edgier and harder, it'd be rap. And
right.
Hip hop was like De La Soul or something.
Right.
You know? So,
right.
I can't really, there's so much has changed in the industry from the point of people making money from music, selling CDs and selling cassette tapes. Artists were making pennies in comparison to the record labels. But nowadays, like, it's all about streams. And many artists are grinding and they're not, you know, because you're getting pennies from streams. And most people are not releasing physical product. So you have to tour. And right now, there's no touring. So I feel really badly for artists that relied on touring because there are a lot of people that have come through Beer Wax, whether they're DJs and MCs, that are just like that middle ground,
right.
Not platinum selling artists, but made decent money to buy a house because they were touring for most like 200 days of the year across Europe and Japan and Eastern Europe and made some decent money. And now like that's kind of gone for this whole year. So hopefully many of those folks have saved up money and had a cushion because the industry in general on so many levels has been destroyed because of this pandemic.
So let's go back to the young Black Cloud.
Yeah. Right?
The one that wrote that letter. Who would you write that letter to in the brewery scene right now if that was you?
In the brewery scene?
I'm putting you on the spot on that one.
Oh, goodness gracious. I would say if I was still the 19-year-old Black Cloud.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
I probably would have written that to Dogfish Head because I was like, Dogfish Head was one of those gateway breweries for me.
Same.
You know, with 90 Minute. Yeah. It was more like, you know, that was like my beginning of like having double IPAs.
And 120, right?
Yeah, I mean, 120 was like a gem to find, you know? So, and just the packaging, like back in the day, it was all bombers. It was a little more expensive. So it was like, it felt exclusive. I've been down to Rehoboth Beach. I've been to the brewery. I've been very impressed by visiting. So I had a very deep love for Dogfish Head because if they have that place as like now kind of more of an OG brewery that was doing great things back in the beginning of my love of craft beer. So the naive maestro, the naive Black Cloud would have been throwing a lot of shade at them to partner in quote unquote and teaming up with Boston Beer Company.
Right.
Or selling most of their business to Boston Beer Company. Whatever the business transaction was, at the end of the day, now as an entrepreneur, I understand you have to make decisions that will, A, benefit your company in the long run, put yourself in a position of success for many, many years in the future, and hopefully continue to maintain your integrity in doing so. So I think now, with the knowledge and wisdom, I won't be as mad at them for doing what they did.
And I think Sam Adams is a good company to go to.
Yes.
Right? So. Versus AB Bev or something.
Exactly. So I'm not talking about, obviously, like Blue Points or whatever has happened with Ballast Point. They sold and then they get sold here and there and then they're independent again. But like there's a lot of companies that sold out to AB and Bev or...
And suffered.
With Constellation Brands in Mexico. And it just, it dilutes the brand.
Do you think it's... because they were purchased by that corporation that dilutes the brand? Or do you think that what comes with that organization and then the sacrifices you end up making is what dilutes the brand? Like, what do you think that is? Because I look at Bourbon County. I think they're owned by AB Bev, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they are.
But this, man, every year BCBS comes out. I grab a bottle because it's still good.
People don't wait in line anymore.
No, I definitely don't.
But people definitely still grab bottles.
Yeah.
And that will be maybe the one kind of unicorn that's owned by a macro company that people will still continue to support and purchase. I think it's the way... Well, A, first of all, I think there's just still like... For like the diehard craft beer person, they see that now they're owned by a macro company. They're like, oh, F you. I'm not going to purchase that anymore. That's where I stand, at least with this bar.
Right.
We will never... Like once we were getting beer from Platform, out of Ohio, and they recently sold to a macro company, think AB InBev, and I... Like, no, no more. Like, I will not support. And just because that's our stance, we want to support independently run and owned craft breweries. But from a personal standpoint, for example, Blue Point out on Long Island, one of the OG Long Island craft breweries, and Blue Point, the deal was for several million, probably not big money in comparison to like Ballast Point and a bunch of other places that also sold, but enough that the family that created Blue Point is set for life. That's the dream of like those startup tech companies, right? You make something that's really dope and then someone buys you out and you make a lot of money. So they, Blue Point and the folks that founded Blue Point are probably going to be very okay and their grandchildren may be okay for a while. So I'm not going to knock anyone individually for making those decisions, but I do know as a purchaser of beer, I'm not going to buy that anymore.
So you had mentioned in a podcast, and I forget which one, so I do apologize. It might have been Hop Talk. Again, I'm not 100% sure.
What's up, Forrest?
Pre-COVID, the thoughts were going through on possibly franchising it.
Yes.
Yeah. So that kind of goes into what we're just speaking about. If that were to happen, hopefully that can be business gets back to usual in the short term versus the long term, because I know it's hard. How would you go about ensuring that your brand stays the way it is now? This is a beautiful space and you got lucky, right? This didn't need any reno.
Very little. We broke down the kitchen and we did some things, but not what you would expect in an empty slate.
Right. You know, it was almost turnkey.
Yeah, for in many ways.
And so being able to do that, is that something you would look to branch out in different states or keep somewhere local and just expand within the New York City area? Mm-hmm. Like how do you keep, this is your baby.
Yeah.
This is 30 years plus of experiences mm-hmm. and love,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right.
In here. And if you look up your Yelp reviews, look up your Google reviews, mm-hmm. you talk about people on Instagram,
mm-hmm.
and the people that visit here, whether they're hip-hop heads, craft beer, or both, no one has a bad thing to say. You feel it when you come in here. It's mm-hmm. very, very genuine. And it's because you're here and you have a great staff.
Yeah.
How do you spread that out and maintain that? Like, have you thought about that process? Are you worried at all if you were going to do that?
There were definitely were very kind of loose conversations before COVID around branching out. And it really was because certain people approached me about, oh, I love Beer Wax. You know, I live in X city. This would do great where I live.
Absolutely.
And a few of these individuals were in the hip hop community. I was doing in terms of curating great DJs, having the wall of vinyl and loving craft beer and seeing that as an opportunity in their city. And I was, you know, definitely interested before COVID, but there's always the fear of, you know, because I am the full-time operator of Beer Wax. How do I take a step back to then have my hands on multiple things to ensure that the quality stays the same? That's the big thing. It's always like a time equation, time and energy. I'm in my, at this point, mid-40s. So, you know, I don't have the same vigor and energy as in my early 20s. But I would need to make sure that if you go to a Beer Wax in LA, for example, that it's going to look and feel like this original location. So it's not something that I'm rushing into, but there's been enough interest from people. But it's something that potentially in a couple of years when we get past this pandemic, and quite frankly, when, you know, that I have some extra capital to play with, because that does take money. And as it is with how things have been going for this past year, we're just hanging on barely.
Yeah. And what I think is interesting for any potential investors out there, what I think is really interesting is that this is pretty simple on paper. Hip-hop, craft beer.
Yeah.
It feels like it can be easily duplicated.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've been here before and if you haven't, I highly encourage that you do. Even with the outdoor dining, which is what I experienced. I never got to really experience the indoor aspect of it. I just sat outside and back here.
Okay.
Right?
Huh.
And it left a mark on me. There's an essence to it. There's a rawness to it. There's a, I don't know, there's a finesse, a vibe, if you will. I hate to use that word, but that kind of puts it together. And you can't just duplicate that. That takes staff.
Yeah.
Right? There's professionals, psychology professionals that can go in and design a room to make you feel a certain way.
Mm.
Right? But it's really the staff and then the underworks of passion that brings that through. So that would be pretty cool to experiment with. But looking at where you're at right now and the situations that have, and, you know, there's vaccine out and there's a lot of conversations, both positive and negative around that. But it looks like there's the starting process of this to end, but it doesn't look like it's happening soon. And so I really have two parts questions for you. A, while you've exhibited some leadership between your former jobs and obviously working as a bar manager in Finback, as an owner operator, that's something that you did for the first time in this role. I'm curious, how did you go in and really start to build a leadership persona, right?
Because
you can't be everybody's friend. You have to be an owner-operator. This is your livelihood. You have two daughters, you have a wife, and you need to ensure that this works out well, not just for you and your family, but for the people that are part of the Beer Wax family, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about learning that? Did you read books? Did you take a course? Or is it something that you really just learned on the fly? Managing people is not easy, as well as managing a P&L if you've never done it before.
Yeah. My background in education, my bachelor's was history, but my master's was in business, was sustainable business, and social responsibility was the actual degree. But you can learn certain things just by reading books, you know, and I did read quite a few books about leadership and about running businesses before opening Beer Wax. But again, a lot of that in terms of leadership, in terms of managing people, was from hands-on experience. My previous job in the hospitality industry, I was the director of an adolescent pregnancy prevention program at an all-girls middle and high school. And when I jumped into that role, I was supervising 23 people. And that was a lot. And it was kind of a trial by fire. And, you know, I'm sure I made a ton of mistakes. But I was there for 5 years. Slowly, that program dwindled down and we were phasing out of that school. And we lost funding. So that last year, I was managing, I think, 10 people. But it was still more than we've ever had it in terms of bartending staff here at Beer Rack. So I feel like, especially from the frame of reference of being in education and managing people from all fields, whether they were social workers, sex educators, financial literacy experts, there was a certain what's known as firmth, of being firm but being warm at the same time. And that was from my mentor, Dr. Carrera. Give him a shout out.
You have to show emotional intelligence, right?
Yeah, you have to. And you have to come at it from a place of compassion.
Yeah.
You know, this is a business, but these are real people and lives at stake. So every single one of our staff members are people that I care about deeply. But I also hold them accountable for the success of this business. Mm-hmm. So
it's a fine line, right?
It's a fine line. But if it wasn't for their excellence and sticking to protocols and making sure that there is communication from me to them as much as possible about what I do expect as the owner and operator, as the captain of the ship, it would fall apart.
Yeah, right. I mean, I always love to hear about how businesses run. It's kind of my thing. And I think specifically around how people lead. And there's a couple things I want to bring up. You had mentioned once that you were scared that you were being too transparent with your staff.
Especially around COVID. And when we were really struggling, and I didn't want people to be worried about their jobs, but I also wanted to be very clear.
Right.
But I know you were, I'm sorry to
cut you off. No, by all means, like, listen. And so I think I'm a firm believer of just setting clear expectations. Mm-hmm. And if there's a certain way you want something done, be clear on what that is. Mm-hmm. And if there's flexibility on how something gets done and you don't mind, then be clear on that as well.
Yeah.
But I've respected that because it's really easy not to avoid the conversation. Mm-hmm. It's even easier to lie. But being transparent, especially on being an entrepreneur, is scary.
Yeah.
Because you think maybe the people that you've come to grow with and feel are a big part of this culture of this enterprise, right, will leave you.
Yeah.
Right? And that's scary. And that might be the best thing for them. It may not be. Mm-hmm. But at no point in time can anyone call you a liar or being malicious in some shape or form. So it is the path to go. It earns, I believe, long-term respect.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it's difficult. It's hard. How did you navigate through that?
In terms of the transparency?
Yeah. And just to be clear,
we're
saying, hey, I don't know if you can be able to work here anymore or if I can afford to pay you.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we're talking about if you guys are not catching.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, and there was the very beginning of COVID and the shutdown in March 16th. I don't think I'll ever forget that day. Within a couple of days of having to let everyone know that I'm going to have to officially like lay everyone off. Because there was no way knowing that what was coming down the pike, I would have to be able to maintain a staff of 7+. It was really, those first couple of months, it was just me behind the bar and a couple of folks that were really volunteering for tips coming in. And, you know, most people were on unemployment. But then when I was able to get things back slowly, we got, you know, PPP money came in. I was able to hire people back. We were in a pretty okay place, but not great.
Mm-hmm.
But then the savings were still dwindling. And then there was a point come, I think, late June or July that I was communicating with both partners of mine and staff that we may not make it past October. Because if we're losing $15,000 a month, based on how much we have in the bank as a cushion, we're not going to make it to October. That's math. So I didn't want people to just live in this bubble and think like their job is secure when, because of the pandemic and the real lack of government intervention besides, you know, a couple of loans.
Right. That was a lot of controversy around.
I mean, now more than before, because at least we had EIDL and you had PPP that was able to give us a lift. But right now, there is nothing. And there's a lot of talk around the hospitality industry, even with the potential, well, it's going to happen, the passage of this new stimulus. There's not a lot that's earmarked for this industry. So it's really tough. And especially right now with the inequity in rules in New York State, you can just go to Long Island and you can still sit indoors and hang out and feel like you're at a bar.
I was at District 96 in New City.
I was
sitting inside the bar.
Yeah. I was there about a month ago.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know if it is, I don't think it's a dramatic, you know, it's this huge disparity in terms of numbers and COVID rates. But I think there's just that fear of there's so many, it's just that so many more people in New York City. So they are so much more, they meaning Cuomo and SLA, strict with these rules. But there was an interesting, you see all these memes on Instagram, mm-hmm. of like people at Roosevelt Field Mall, packed, Christmas right. shopping, packed. But you can't have 12 people inside this bar, 6 feet apart, enjoying a beer and a meal.
How much of that do you think is policy for just to have a policy or a safeguard for people within this group of bars and areas like taking advantage of it? I see a lot of stuff online where they're like, hey, there's 30 people inside when there aren't supposed to be 30 people inside. And I can only just see how that can mess it up for everybody else.
Yeah, it is true. And especially there were times where you would see over the summer, like huge crowds gathering and it not really following the protocols and the mandates of the state. And knowing that there's still, I mean, I am a believer in science. I'm not a doubter of COVID right. being a thing.
Right.
You know,
right.
many
You're
people
a rational
are,
human being.
Yeah. You know, and, right. and I've known people personally that have passed away from COVID. Yeah. So, I mean, no one that thankfully has been extremely close to me, but, you know, like 1 or 2 degrees of separation and sudden couldn't visit their parent for 2 weeks and then they died. You know, jeez. It's like, this is real. I have one of my closest friends. He's a doctor and is in the front lines of stuff. So I hear, we talk all the time. So I hear of what is happening in terms of hospitals and patients and the overcrowding of hospitals. So it's a very real thing. So on one hand, I understand the livelihood of so many in the hospitality industry that are suffering. There are folks that are undocumented that are now without any lifeline, which are many folks that are in kitchens, right? So there are folks like myself that are entrepreneurs that put their lives on the line, put all their savings to make this dream happen that is just seeming like just come is falling down right now. So there's that. But then there's the other end of like, we don't want to be in a place where we are just packing a bar with 60 people and
almost
now
losing your liquor license.
Yeah, right? You know, it's complicated. I have a hard time with it because I see both sides, but I do want equity in terms of how you make these laws and mandates.
Well, listen, the restaurants, bars are the lifeline of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Me living in Northern New Jersey,
yep.
only reason why I come to New York City, you know, when I was younger, it's come to clubs, right? Mm-hmm. And now is to go to a nice restaurant or yep. go to a nice bar.
Go to a brewery.
Right, go yeah. to a brewery, yep. so forth and so on. And if you don't provide support for these, what's the reason for me to come?
Yeah.
Right? And that affects the livelihoods of mm-hmm. thousands upon thousands exactly. of people.
I think at the end of the day, if this pandemic during this winter surge becomes out of control and you need to shut down bars and restaurants fully, yes. But have a plan to support those bars and restaurants.
Right.
Have some kind of way to make sure that they don't close.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing from government that's actually doing that or saying that. So,
right. And there's so many levels to it, right?
Yeah.
There's you, and then there's the landlord, and then mm-hmm. there's all these other places that kind of like, well, hey, what happens if someone doesn't pay? And then obviously all the distributors and partners that you work with.
I mean, it's like the it's symbiotic relationship that, between all these entities. It's right. incredible.
Yeah.
Just our landlords have been incredible for the past 3.5 years.
Wow.
Because we took time to open up. They've been great, but they're also reliant on us as a source of income. So they can't just say, oh, don't worry about paying us. Because
right.
that's also the way that they survive too. And they're not, you know, they're pretty well off. But the amount of money that comes from this rent, which is substantial, is something that they plan on.
So what is, there's a couple of things that you can do. In my opinion, and mm-hmm. I'm no expert. You can wait and hope,
mm-hmm.
which will probably mean die.
There's only so many months to lose X amount of money.
Right.
And it's looking again like it's going to be like 15 a month.
And so what, like, as an entrepreneur going into this stage, you're given, to me, a puzzle that people haven't figured out yet, but that you have to.
And it's always changing. Right? Right. That puzzle is always shifting and rearranging. So you're always looking at it from a different angle.
Almost like Tetris, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what are some of the things that you can do on, have you thought about things that you can do differently to supplement the lost income? I think of breweries, right? A lot of breweries are in some cases better off now than they were the pandemic. I don't think the brewery structure that we have now is going to go away when everything clears up.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to continue to deliver now. They're probably yeah. going to stay away from line releases, maybe. The best thing for them would be, all right, people is going to start buying kegs again, which yeah. would be great. But for you, what are your thought process on innovating? It's like, okay, well, I need to make revenue just to minimize that hole in that bucket of revenue streaming out, or really just profit streaming out to pay the bills. What can you do differently? Have you thought about that? It's got to be more than just serving beer in the front and the back, right? Is there something else that you can do?
I mean, that's the hard thing with bars. I mean, breweries, in a sense, are at an advantage. They can pivot in an easier way. Like, for example, Finback, at the beginning of the pandemic, they had more than half of their inventory in kegs. And when they realized that they were going to sell any kegs to restaurants and bars, they were able to put all that into cans and they sold it all. They were able to maybe let go of a few people and then hire more people because they were continuing to put product in cans and get it out to the public. We rely on seating people and having people consume beer and a meal. And a meal for us is a snack per se. Whatever is
peanut and jelly chips.
Whatever's going to allow us to say that it's a meal for the SLA and for Cuomo. But we typically, a small bar is profitable because it packs the bar and gets as many people to buy something and hopefully send them out and get more people to come in and send them out. We cannot pack a bar. And we have limited number of seating. So there isn't a lot we can do to get to where we need to be. We were where we needed to be and even better in the summer because of open streets. So Vanderbilt Avenue, with the support and the guidance, I should say, of Gibb and the folks from the Prospect Heights, it's kind of like a community association kind of thing. They spearheaded the application to Department of Transportation. And we were quickly granted and granted permission to close the streets from Friday through Sunday and then be able to take over the street, put tables out. So that happened from August through right before Thanksgiving. We saw sales numbers sometimes double what we usually did before COVID.
Wow.
So we know that if we get to March when the weather's great again, we'll be able to do that again because that has been extended year round.
So it's still happening now, right?
It's not happening. Because of the weather, because of the potential of snow, because of the cold, most of the restaurateurs decided that they didn't want to do it during the winter. And also the volunteers, it's volunteer run that are marshals that go around to make sure everything's in place, that no one is.
Oh, I didn't know that was volunteer.
Yeah, it's the amount of, there are at least 10 to 15 or 20 that rotate.
Shout out to them.
They're great. That they basically have their vest on, they go around making sure that, because there's a lot of different rules and things to make sure everything is safe when you close the street down. But half of those volunteers said they wouldn't want to volunteer for free, obviously, over the winter. Then that means the restaurants would have to pay for a security service. And many were like, we're not going to have enough people that are going to want to sit out in 20 degree weather when it maybe it's snowing. So we took a pause, but we'll be back with that in late March. So if we can hold on from now at this point, it's almost the end of December, January, February, most of March, 3 months. We'll be in a better place. But in terms of trying to figure out another revenue source, we'll continue to do beer to go, even if they do announce, and by the time people hear this, maybe it's already a thing, a full shutdown where we're deemed, like in the early days of COVID, an essential business. We can sell beer to go and food to go, but that's it. No one can really come and stay backyard front.
You can sell beer to go now.
We can sell beer to go, but that's going to be such a drop in the bucket because we've experienced that already. We'll make really less than a third of what we usually make. So we'll do it. And I'm doing it more to keep people employed. Other places have already opted to shut down for the winter until they can have people back inside. I'll keep pushing it and pay employees as long as it makes sense and a little bit of money that can go towards rent and our other bills.
Right.
So,
yeah, I see. I've reached out to Tom from Monk's Cafe. I don't know if you've ever been there at all.
In Philly?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know the owners or anything, but yeah.
Yeah, no, he's a cool dude. He's an OG. Yeah, he tapped the first Belgian keg in 1995. And
they have Russian River all the time.
Yeah, you know, yeah, so, yeah. On tap. It's on tap all day. But yeah, he was the first to crack open a Belgian keg in the U.S. And he's been doing cellar sales. So he's an OG OG. Like this guy goes 80s. Wow. He's personal friends with the guys from Cantillon.
Wow.
And he's
which is crazy. Like,
yeah. He has just really rare...
I mean, the cellar must be insane.
Cellar, Lambic collection.
Wow.
And he's had collabs with Cantillon, with Tired Hands.
That's amazing.
I don't know if he had a collab with Three Fontaine or not, but yeah, he's going through his cellar sale and he's selling them for $150, $200. This super rare Three Fontaine just went on sale on his site yesterday. for $500, right? Mm. And to me, I was like, oh, that's a good idea, right?
I'm sure buying it.
And Philly's complete, I think it's complete shutdown.
Is it right now?
Yeah. I think they were the first to shut down indoor dining before everybody
else. Okay.
I could be wrong, you know, but I think it's stuff like that. I can't help but try to just understand, like, how do you keep a business like this alive? And there's got to be something else there that won't magically fix your problem because you have so many little options. Yeah. And like you said, it's a puzzle that continuously change.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just curious on your mindset of like, hey, a lot of times people can just focus on the problem that's in front of them and not see mm-hmm. what's around that could be a potential opportunity.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you've like sat down and kind of wondered that, because are you going to make it the next 6 months?
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's a tough question. And yeah. I'm sure you can't answer that right now, yeah. but I know your team is fighting. Mm-hmm. I know you're fighting. I know the community is fighting. But how do you muster through that? How do you kind of center yourself, right? And how do you have a clear state of mind on how to move forward? How do you do that?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it starts with...
Some beer helps.
Beer helps, but also staying grounded and centered. I feel like, personally, I went through the worst of it in June. After really? Dealing with March, April, May of this new reality, by June, I was burnt out. I was like ready to take a step away from the bar and running the bar and getting other people to run it. I mean, like, listen, I'm ready. I'm throwing the towel.
Wow.
I just was like not in a good place spiritually and emotionally.
How could you be?
Yeah.
Right? You're a human being.
Yeah. It was rough. But luckily, I crawled out of that ditch. And luckily, Jesse, who's the assistant manager, one of my partners, Marco, have been super instrumental in supporting. And the whole team is really amazing.
Yeah.
So I was able to really get out of that dark place and realize, like, oh, this is a sinking ship. The captain needs to be still steering the ship.
I would argue that's not sinking, but
in that moment it was.
Okay.
In that moment it was. And I quickly realized, like, oh, I can't walk away now. We're losing $15,000 a month. I got to make sure we do everything I can to make sure we stay open.
Yeah.
And then luckily Open Streets happened and then it turned things around for us. But,
right.
but again, now we're moving in that direction. So I have to have the faith and the optimism that we'll see it through and just do my best to trim any kind of fat that we may have. And there are things that we can do to make some extra money. You know, we were trying to do a lot of merch sales and yeah. stuff, and brings a little bit of money, but it's not great.
You're not going to make your deficit selling t-shirts.
Yeah. And then like even vinyl, like we have a whole bunch of vinyl. I have at least 1,000 records that I have slated to sell.
Okay.
But we have already still, I mean, we have like 20 records on the site, and that moves very slow. So maybe it's just about marketing and making sure people know, like, we have records to sell.
I'll tell you what, man, the Mugs guy, he does a video and posts it in his Instagram. He'll go through the bottles that he has. Like, he can probably go through the vinyls that he has.
And
then
and just post it.
Yeah. And he's like, go to my website for more details.
I think we'll start doing more of that. And that was the dream of, we wanted to really have a more robust online presence for our records that we're selling. And then we thought about Instagram as a way, even just on a story, like, here's a record, swipe up to purchase, you know? So, and if things slow down, I'll have the time to really kind of beef that up.
So let's get out of this.
The dark place.
This is dark place real quick. So I have a question from you that I had posted on my Instagram a little earlier. But before I get into that question that I want to ask you, I want to revisit a question that Steal This Beer, Augie from Carton asked you.
What's up, Augie?
And I love this. And so I'm sorry that I'm stealing this, but at least I'm giving you credit here. Let's go with, and I know this is going to be an extremely tough question for you. Top 5 rappers or hip hop artists.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a person or a group of all time. And then the breweries that you associate with those each. Top 5.
I love it. I'm happy you kind of resurrected this question because.
Should I go through and tell them what you said before?
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
All right.
Because it's going to be very different at this point. Now it's 2018, you said, right?
Okay, yeah. Disclaimer, okay. 2018.
Yeah.
2018, Chris was on a Steal This Beer podcast with Augie, the brewmaster and owner of Carton.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave him 4 names. It was Nas, Jay-Z, Migos at the time, 2018. He was their up and coming. And then Ghetto Boys. And he said, hey, what breweries do you associate with each one? And for Nas, you said Innerborough. You and Innerborough have a great relationship.
We do. Jesse is my homie.
Jesse is the man, by the way. Irene too. Shout out to Irene and Innerborough. But Jesse, you once called him the gentleman from Harlem Hops and gentleman from the Sampler, the People of Color Coalition, Bar Coalition, which I thought
was. And then obviously Jesse's the white dude, but Jesse is proactive in building community.
Yeah.
And from the very beginning of BeerX being a thing and Sampler, Jesse reached out to us and was like, let's do this Presidente series. It's a riff on, you know, Dominican-owned bars. And Uptown Beer Society was involved in that too, Joel. And it was really trying to produce something that can be for a palate of a community that's not really into craft beer. So the first one, I think, was El Prez, and it had a Dominican flag on it.
Yeah.
And then we had Dead Prez. And so Jesse, as A, is a hip-hop head. If you know his beers, they're often hip-hop themed.
He started the whole Run the Jewels movement.
The thing is, like, if people... Often I get asked this, as a man of color, as an entrepreneur in craft beer, I often get asked, like, what about all these breweries that are basically stealing these hip-hop themes that may not even be into hip-hop?
Which is cultural appropriation.
Exactly. It's cultural appropriation. Yeah. But I always argue that Jesse, he basically was the manager of Def Jux, right? He's been a DJ for a long time. He ran LP from Run the Jewels, his label. He's steeped in hip-hop and knows a lot of people. So his heart is in hip-hop. And he's definitely been very supportive of us. And we do a lot of collaborations.
Which led him to you calling him Nas.
Yeah.
Jay-Z was other half.
Yes.
Migos was Hudson Valley.
And I think how it went, if I recall... Oh, yeah, he did ask me, because I wouldn't just throw out Migos for any reason, because I'm not even a fan of Migos.
Right.
But I feel like there was some kind of question around, like, who was the flashy or, like, you know, so he kind of prompted the responses in a sense. But so I was like, oh, flashy or, oh, let's do, you know, Hudson Valley, because at the time they were extremely popular.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, Migos was new at the time. And so that's why I mentioned that,
And then the Ghetto Boys was Industrial Arts.
I don't even remember why I made that connection.
that was the weird one for me.
Yeah.
So before we get into those questions, we're about to pop open another beer.
Hell yeah.
Funny enough, Bomb Atomically.
Oh, nice.
Monkish.
Yes. Shout out to Inspect the Deck.
Inspect the Deck. Who's the one that you didn't have painted? Oh, you got.
You got.
Poor you got.
Yeah. Shout Hopefully he never shows up.
All right. So now that we've given the people a context of where we're going here. So, top five, dead or alive.
Salute.
Salute, my brother. And then the breweries associated with them.
All right. So, I'm going to do... Well, you know, I'm going to just... Whatever came to mind first. And you know what came to mind first was The Alchemist, not the brewery, the producer. And The Alchemist has been producing for a long time. He did beats for Mobb Deep. He's had his own albums. But now he's in this amazing lane where he's producing amazing records with... A lot of artists that are more underground level, Boldy James, Freddie Gibbs. So I kind of feel like for someone that's been in the game for a while, that still keeps it just gritty and grimy and still very real.
It's so funny seeing Alchemist on Fuck That's Delicious. Have you ever seen that show?
Oh, I know.
And you're like, and I'm like, is that the... I always just envision Alchemist as being like this gutted, like just super...
He grew up in Beverly Hills. Like, he's a white dude, grew up privileged. But somehow, I mean, shit, you could probably learn about this or read about this, but Prodigy from Mobb Deep thought that he was like undercover Fed and didn't trust him. He's like, who's this guy who's making these great beats? I don't trust him. Until eventually he realized, oh, he's not a Fed.
That's wild. I never knew that.
Yeah.
Wow. So,
but yeah, so I mean, for someone that's been in the game for a while, that's still doing really cutting edge stuff, I'm going to say...
Just so you guys know, as he's thinking, I don't give the people I interview any pre-scripted questions. I just tell them that I immediately go into explaining their story so they don't have to, because it's usually the question that they mentioned a million times before. And then we just go into natural conversation. So I'm hitting him right now for the first time. He didn't see this coming. You guys see in his eyes right now, he's going deep.
All right.
Here we go.
Here we go. Allagash.
Oh, for Alchemist.
For Alchemist, yeah.
Okay.
Look at that thing about Allagash has been around for their OGs, but the quality of their beers are still on point. And it's unfortunate because they do a lot of stuff that's kind of like only released at the brewery. And if you go, you'll try some of their barrel-aged stuff. You'll try some mixed fermentation stuff that they don't release into the markets in New York City. And it's always on point. Yeah. And I feel like they have maintained a very special place. And I would also throw, now Oxbow has been around for a bit too. And they're still doing and nailing quality.
Can I tell you a funny story about that? I was put on Oxbow here.
Oh, shit.
You had the bottle of Oxbow Magenta.
Oh, man. Yep.
And I never heard of it. And I tasted it and I'm like, wow, this is really good.
Okay, they're great.
Funny enough, I already had a trip planned to Maine.
Oh, shit. So you went to visit?
So I went to visit.
Oh,
and Oxbow was dope because they were open and Oxbow Blending.
Yes, that's the one that's in Portland.
Yeah, it's in Portland. Yeah. And so it's next to a distillery, next to like a bar or whatever. So I went there and I checked them out and I bought a couple of their bottles back home. I should have brought one.
I missed
an opportunity, but they were fantastic. And Allagash was completely shut down, just pickup.
Oh, shit.
But you know what it was to get Allagash White fresh?
Oh, I know. Yeah.
So good.
It's a classic.
So, very, very, very cool. Okay. So we got Alchemist.
Yes.
Allagash.
Yep. Next one. All right. I'm going to start this time by naming the brewery.
Okay.
And I'm going to say Folks Beer.
Okay.
Out in Brooklyn, kind of like right down the block from my other half.
Bomb Pilsners.
Amazing, amazing Pilsners. Amazing. I love Folks Beer.
You said on one podcast, I forget which beer it was, but if you were stuck on an
OBL.
Island. OBL.
Yes,
kegs.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that beer. So I'm going to say.
Now, is Folks Beer old? No, they're fairly new, right?
I would say like 3 years.
And what's interesting about Folks Beer as you know, figure out who the rapper is that they don't make. They're right next to arguably the number one hazy IPA manufacturer in the world, probably the best that do it, right? Or one of the best
If you ever heard of Other Half, this is what he's referring to.
I'm sorry. Yeah, if anyone listens to this podcast, doesn't know what Other Half is. You're listening to the wrong podcast. No, I'm joking. But to be right next door, literally walking distance, and serve really interesting beers like the Pilsners, it's pretty ballsy, but also a niche that needed to be filled. And I just discovered Folks Beer this year. I went and picked up their lime cucumber, which I wasn't a fan of.
Yes, but you didn't like it?
Man.
Okay. Well, you know what? It was just a blend of ice.
Yeah. But I picked up a case of their Pilsners.
And their Pilsners are fantastic.
You know what, man? It's like Suarez and then them as far as like New York, accessible to me, Pilsner.
I got it. So again, just to, as a refresher, this is kind of like the stepchild in a sense, right? You have two breweries that are very close together and one is really heralded world-class and as they should be.
Yes.
And another one that many do respect them, but they don't get the same shine because they're not making, you know, double dry hopped IPAs and churning that out. And obviously there's a cult of Other Half, but Folks Beer is doing amazing stuff. So I would say this is a deep cut, but rapper Big Pooh. Little Brother is the group, and you have Fonte and rapper Big Pooh. Fonte is an incredible MC. Big Pooh often is like, oh, he's not as good. Often is in any duo of a hip-hop group, there's always one that's like, he's not as good as the other. But I feel like Big Pooh has a very good catalog. And if you really dig into his discography, you'll find some great, stellar projects.
Okay.
So I'm going to say rapper Big Pooh as the Folks Beer.
Okay, and this is your top five.
Let's do it. We got three more.
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
We do. Okay.
Take a sip so I can think on the next one.
I'm happy that you're giving this legit thought. You're not just sitting in it.
I got to make sure.
By the way, sharing an IPA is so much better than drinking the whole can by yourself.
Oh, I know. That's true. Okay, I get my next one. Okay. The brewery is Drownlands.
Oh, man.
And
also just discovered them.
They have been only around, I think they're like a pandemic open. They've only been around for less than a year.
Beautiful brewery out in Warwick. Yeah, literally just there 2 weeks ago.
Incredible. They are
beautiful.
They're to me, and I always give a lot of props and shouts to Torst. It's one of the craft beer bars that influenced Beer Wax and I fell in love with. And I used to give you a quick tidbit. I used to take my potential investors to Torst. To woo them. And they go, this is what a craft beer bar can look like.
Shout to Jeppy, right? Jeppy started that.
Yes. Correct? Yeah. So, and also shout to Mike, who used to be the beer buyer and one of the main dudes over, he's now in Las Vegas, but Metal Mike put me onto Oxbow. So, really great guy. But yeah, so I digress. Drownlands. That's where we were. Drownlands. It reminds me of Torst. It's beautiful inside, pristine. Just the layout is gorgeous. And the beer, I think it's phenomenal. What they're doing in terms of like, you know, mixed culture, farmhouse ales, barrel aged farmhouse ales. Their IPAs have really been on point.
What I like about their IPAs is that some people will call them thin, right? and a negative connotation. Yeah. And that's just truly not the case. Mm-hmm. I had just one with like lemon zest in it. I think it was called Loom.
Okay.
And it was absolutely incredible. And I had one of their pastry stouts that were really good as
well. Yeah, they're doing. And if you have any of their saisons, anything that's aged in oak, fantastic.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. And listen, they're not really that far in comparison to like a Suarez or mm-hmm. even an Equilibrium. Yep. They're right in Warwick. It's an absolutely stunning location. Mm-hmm. In the summer, I can only imagine how great that backyard would be. Starting to get a lot of hype.
Yeah, they are. So that's why I'm looking through my list here, and I'm going to tell you who exactly I would equate them with. I'm going to say 38 Spesh. If you haven't heard of 38 Spesh, and if you haven't heard of Drownlands, you have to check them both out. 38 Spesh, I believe, is out of Rochester. There's a whole movie in upstate New York. I'm sure a few people have heard of Griselda Records, Conway, West Side Gun, Benny the Butcher. He's not far. He's over in Rochester. They're from Buffalo, but he has a movement too. And he's producing so many different artists. He's a really good MC in his own right, great producer, and he's very prolific. He's released at least 10 projects this year.
Wow.
He runs very closely with Che Noor, female MC out of Buffalo. Really dope. And I feel like right now he's almost there. Now he didn't just come out. He's been grinding for a while, but a lot of people don't know about him yet, and he's really dope. So I want to say 38 Spesh is Drownlands.
Okay. I like what you're doing here, man. I like what you're doing here. So I'm assuming the next one's going to be Brewery First again.
Let's see. Well, you know, I'm also very visual, so I got to look through my...
Your playlist here?
My list here. Oh, okay. There we go.
You had mentioned previously, I think Outkast was one of your tops, right?
Yeah. I love Andre 3000.
This goes back to like what you were saying before, like Big Boy's there.
Yes.
And you got to respect Big Boy.
Yes. But Andre.
Andre's Andre.
I mean, pretty much every duo is like that same act.
Right.
You know.
What's interesting, you know, as you marinate and think, mm-hmm. I recently read an article that Andre doesn't feel like he's one of the GOATs. That
really?
He's like super like self-conscious.
Wow. And doesn't think that. Is that why he's not rapping anymore? It's so,
that's exactly,
makes me so mad.
That's exactly why.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Next one up.
I wish you guys could see his face right now. He is looking in the air.
Yeah.
He keeps on just going through, pulling thoughts.
We're going to do Hudson Valley.
Okay.
No, sorry. Not Hudson Valley, because we did that already. We're going to do Hill Farmstead this time.
Ooh.
We're going to do Hill Farmstead.
So Hill Farmstead, number one brewery in the world. Fight me.
Yeah.
Right? Prolific. A scientist.
Yes.
A perfectionist.
Sean Hill.
Sean Hill is absolutely incredible. Yeah. Also, an incubator for a lot of dope breweries that exist
right.
today.
Suarez. Exactly.
The Vale out in Richmond.
Yeah.
Right? Has won countless awards. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, my first episode was with Pete Oates from Equilibrium, mm-hmm. brewmaster, owner. And he actually proposed to his wife under a bottle of barrel-aged Damien.
Oh, man.
And him and actually Michelle DeLuca, the brand director of Equilibrium, not at the same time, they didn't know each other at the time, but would make the same day trip from New York all the way to Hill Farmstead and back just to get bottles.
I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, 7 hours, like people do it.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I kind of want to do it.
Yeah. I always go up to Stowe, hang out for a weekend, and then make a little side trip to Hill Farmstead.
Burlington for me, man.
Oh, wow. Burlington's great.
Yeah, Burlington's super
dope. Maybe Foam will show up as one of these, but.
Uh-oh.
So Hill Farmstead and Rakim.
Ooh. And absolutely.
What you said is the reason why I chose Rakim, that the influence that Hill Farmstead has had on other, like you said, like Vale, like Suarez, like many others.
First mainstream technical rapper?
Yes.
Because he went within the bars, but he was also like the first to go out of the bars. Right.
And just like talking, the way that he was putting together his rhymes and the way that he's incorporating 5% Nation stuff and science and math, and no one was doing that.
Nope.
And he influenced so many MCs.
Yep. Wu-Tang.
Wu-Tang to Nas to, you know, there are so many after that can say that Rakim was the blueprint for them.
Absolutely.
So, Hill Farmstead.
Absolutely. That's dope.
Oh, thank you.
That's my favorite one.
We got two more.
That's my favorite one. There's this really dope video on the Vox about MCs that break through the bars. Google it. I don't remember the name of it at first, but it's this girl that's like a, I have to believe that she's super, like, music is her study. Because she's done a lot of different, like, type of videos. But check it out. It's really, really dope.
Oh, yeah, I see that. All right, I'm getting there to my next. Getting there.
So, for those who don't know, back in the day, it was about the DJ first. Then someone would just be an MC.
Eric B. and Rakim.
Right. It was just an MC.
Yeah.
And an MC would just kind of be, at the time, like a hype man.
Yeah.
Right? And spit some words and so forth and so on. But Eric B. and Rakim was a thing. But I feel like Rakim was maybe one of the first mainstream. It's hard to call him mainstream, but an era of hip hop, I guess he would be at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was like the focus wasn't on the DJ. Yeah. It was on Rakim because how talented he was.
Ooh, man.
Like Jazzy Jeff and
the Fresh Prince. Yeah.
You have to correct me if I'm wrong, because again, I will far call myself an enthusiast, but I told my wife, this is how my brain works. You get a bunch of wet sand and then duct tape stretched out, and you just throw the sand at the duct tape, or whatever sticks is what I remember.
Oh shit, exactly.
Just look at it. That's how it
is. All right, I got something here.
Okay. Last but not least.
No, I got a good one.
Here it is.
And this is a bit of a repetition.
Okay.
But I'm going to say Tired Hands.
Ooh.
And
shout out to Sean.
And I'm
going to
say why. I'm not going to say the MC until I explain.
Go.
Tired Hands at a time was like other half, Treehouse, Tired Hands. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like they've lost a little bit of their reputation. A little bit of their respect.
I'll tell you, if you're a Milkshake IPA fan.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you are a Saison fan. Tired Hands still execute, in my opinion, an extremely high level. Their Saisons are incredible.
They're really great. But I don't hear about them. I'm not in the whole trading circles anymore or the line culture anymore. But I don't hear about them with the same respect that I used to.
Right.
So I'm going to say Nas.
Oh.
Because the last couple of Nas projects have been eh.
Right.
And I kind of feel like he's really fallen off. And not to say that they've fallen off, because I do agree.
No doubt.
I personally still love Tired Hands.
Right.
And I've been recently to the Fermenteria. The food is fantastic.
Yeah, Carnitas Tacos are shit.
Their food is great. I love it there. And I feel like their beer is still really great. But in terms of what I hear from people, they've fallen off a little bit. But that also just may be just a particular portion of people who think they've fallen off.
Well, listen, people trade for different things, but it's really two types of beers that people are primarily trading for.
What, Imperial Stouts and…
Stouts and IPAs, right? And so they're not really doing any of those two. They do IPAs, but their Saisons, I hope it never blows up because I want to be able to show up to their general store.
Sometimes we get some half kegs of their stuff. And they're expensive and I will pay for it because it's so good.
So their Saisons could be Illmatic, you know?
Yeah,
and
seriously.
Stillmatic after that.
Exactly. But I will stick with Nas… is still
icon,
and maybe still my top five. Maybe.
Okay.
I have a shirt that has my top five.
Oh,
and Nas is on there, but because of this last album, and
I feel like he does this stuff to pay the bills, man. Like, I feel like some rappers do that,
but I feel like Nas has let me down as of recent,
right?
And doesn't hold the same place as he did before,
right?
So that's why I'll say, although I think Tired Hands is probably doing better than Nas. Because I'm really disappointed with Nas these days.
It's funny, like, for me, Jay-Z, who's in my top five, and a lot of people sometimes would get upset with me on that, which is weird, because, like, are you talking about commercial success?
Yeah.
Right?
No, I think Jay-Z is a phenomenal. He's in my top 10.
I'll tell you, man, like, he continues, he's still rapping.
Yeah.
And he's still putting quality verses out there with music that means stuff. It's just not corrupt along where I'm from, Mars.
Ain't nothing nice.
You know, it's stuff where he's relevant and he's talking about, hey, man, like, I'm trying to triple my wealth. And
he's rapping about what he knows now.
Right.
Which it's better than him still rapping about the streets. He's not in the streets.
It wouldn't be real. Exactly. It wouldn't be authentic. He'd be like, shut up, dude. I saw you in a jet ski with the best.
Exactly. Right, he's rapping about his mom. His mom, like, coming out. That's real. That's real. That's his.
Yep.
What he's dealing with and versus, you know, something that you can't really believe. Like, you are, how much money is he? He's like half a billionaire at this point.
Who knows, man? Honestly, who knows?
Yeah.
Okay, so last question, and then we're going to wrap this up. This is from Instagram user m.a.t.tk.l.e.i.n, Matt Klein.
Oh, I know Matt.
Shout out to Matt.
What's up, Matt?
What is your favorite record in your beer wax collection?
Ooh. This kind of question is like asking someone, what's the best meal they've ever eaten? It's hard to remember and it's hard to actually figure that out. So just in case Matt sees this, man, that's a hard question, man. I can't answer that, but I'll try my best. I'm going to say my favorite record, one of my favorite MCs, he's on my top five. And again, I'm going deep for many people, but Organized Confusion, their first record, self-titled Organized Confusion. I'm not sure the year it came out in, I think 1991, but both Pharoah Monch and Prince Po have been here to Beer Wax, and they both have signed the record. And I love the record, but the fact that both MCs that don't really rock together like that anymore have been here and have signed that record, it just means the world to me.
Boom.
Yeah.
There you go, Matt Klein.
There you go, Matt.
Chris, man, honestly, I can't thank you enough. This was a super dope conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Hey,
Marcel, thank you.
All I did, guys, was email him. He responded back fast. I joke around and say, hey, man, I'm a nobody. I got 1,300 followers, which is nothing in comparison to most of these people and a few hundred people that listen to this podcast. And for you to take the time to be the owner of one of the few vinyl playing only record shops / craft beer places and the first to do it, it's truly an honor to sit in front of you and have a beer with you, my man.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Cheers, myself.
Salute, my brother.
Salute, brother.